This is Rosemary Hall recording for the Dialect and Heritage Project at the University of Leeds. It's Saturday the 8th of October 2022. And could I ask you please to introduce yourself?
Fran Gillespie.
And Fran, what's your connection with the Survey of English Dialects?
Well, when I graduated from Leeds University's English department in 1964, I didn't know what I was going to do. I'd got married at the end of my second year to an assistant keeper from Temple Newsome House, which is a museum on the outskirts of Leeds. And I was wondering about what sort of a job, and I didn't want to do a postgraduate teaching diploma, although I did one later. And I was thinking about what to do, and I think the professor or my tutor suggested that I do some sort of qualification. It wasn't a master's, but it was something that began with M in the folklore department. So I met Dr. Stuart Sanderson, and we talked about me working on some project. And he said, by the way, they're looking for people to help with the dialect survey. Would you like a little job working as an assistant editor? So I said yes, I would, and it was very badly paid. It was £600 a year, which was really pitiful pay, but anyway, I didn't mind, and it was an interesting job. And I actually gave up after about a year. I gave up working for this qualification I was doing in folklore. I can't even remember now what the name of the qualification was or what the topic was, but whatever it was, I decided I really wasn't that interested in it. So I gave up that bit, but I continued on the dialect survey, I think probably from, it must have been about September 1964 until just before my daughter was born in July 66. So I probably gave up about June in 66, something like that.
Can you describe your role a little bit for me?
Well, I was assistant editor with a man called Dr. Martin Wakelin, and we sat opposite each other at one end of the room, and there were other people working on the survey. I think there might have been four other people working in the room, but I didn't really get to know them that well. Their desks were further down the room, and I can't remember their names now. There was one other lady working there, but she left very soon after I arrived. She left, so I was the only woman who was working on it during the time that I was there.
What was that like?
Well, I was rather indignant when I found out the men thought it was my job to make the tea and coffee, because I didn't mind taking a share, but they seemed to think they could obviously they'd somehow conned this other female into being the tea and coffee maker. And I thought, well, I made it clear that I was prepared to do my share, but I wasn't going to do it every single day, and I wasn't going to do all the washing up either. So we got that sorted out fairly early on.
And you talk about being seated at different ends of the room. Which room was that?
Well, there was a row of red brick terraced houses at the back of the university, and the whole row belonged to the university. And it was in one of those. I just remember it was a typical sort of 1890s late Victorian villa. It was a bit cramped, but anyway, there was one long room. I think it might have been two rooms knocked into one, actually. And we all worked in there. We had these desks where we sat opposite each other.
And what did your job entail?
Well, it was a long time ago. I can't remember a lot of it, but it was mainly transcribing. In we had blank notebooks. Oh, by the way, when I took on the job, I didn't even know the International Phonetic Alphabet, let alone the extra dozen or so symbols that Harold Orton had invented, because the phonetic alphabet didn't cover all the sounds they needed, so there were extra symbols. So I had to very quickly learn these over the weekend. I knew some of the International Phonetic Alphabet, but not all of it, and I had to very quickly mug it up before I took on the job. And I was a little bit shaky to begin with. So it was mainly transcribing, I think, from recordings into a notebook. But the people who'd done all the field work had finished by that stage, I think in the 50s. And I heard some of their stories, which were told to me. And I think occasionally one or two of them popped in to see how we were doing, but I didn't really meet any of them. I was interviewed for the job by Harold, and I liked him very much indeed. And he was famous for his almost supernatural powers of instantly detecting where somebody had come from. And he hadn't talked to me very long before he said, "You're from Cambridgeshire." And in fact, I was born and brought up in Cambridge, but I only lived there till I was 8 and a half. After that, we moved to Surrey. But Harold knew. And I remember another colleague of mine saying that at one time as a child, he had lived in Germany. He was British, but he'd lived in Germany after World War II, at the time when the British were administering a sector in Germany. And Harold detected that he had lived in Germany. And I swear he hadn't looked at this chap's CV. He said he could tell from his accent, which seemed quite amazing. But Harold was famous for these sort of things. So I had an interview with him, and then I started the job.
Can you describe a typical day?
Well, apart from making tea and coffee, just doing this writing. I wish I could remember more details of exactly what it was we were transcribing. I just remember writing a lot in these blank notebooks, unlined paper, and writing everything and Martin checking it, and then me looking at what Martin was doing. We sort of sat on opposite. I was his assistant. I think that was mainly what I had to do. But I also worked on what I found very interesting was mapping the different dialect words for certain things. And I remember very clearly working on a map for the different words around the country for what is generally known as a levensy. It's the snack that you have mid-morning. And we found all these different names from it all over the country. And they were transcribed onto a map. And there were other maps we did as well. And I was absolutely thrilled when I visited the Rydale Folk Museum a few months ago. And somebody there who was involved with the dialect survey showed me some of the material, and there was the map I'd worked on, and I was so tickled to actually see it after all those years. I'd forgotten about it. And when I saw it, I said, "Oh my God, I worked on that myself." It was amazing.
What was the process of making those maps? How did you actually do it?
Well, again, my memory, I'm sorry, but my memories are very vague because it was such a long time ago, and I'm not a linguist. It wasn't really my subject at all. I was an amateur just helping out. I remember now how we did it. Children were asked questions like, you had to be very, very careful, I know, when they were asking questions, not to use the word that might prompt them. You had to do it in a sort of circular way. And it was something like, what's the name for something you take to eat or drink in the middle of the morning? This is for school children. And then what you did was make lists of all the names throughout the English counties. And then, of course, a lot of them formed clusters. And then those clusters eventually went onto the map. It was nothing to do with county boundaries whatsoever. Those clusters went onto the map, as far as I remember, and that's how we did it.
And yeah. was the map laid out on a table?
I think so, yes. It's hard for me to remember, Rosie, because I was only there a short time, really, and I don't remember a lot of details.
How did it feel to see that map at Rydale?
It was something I hadn't thought about since I left in 66, and I was just amazed to see it. Yeah. Well, I did enjoy hearing some of the stories that I was told about the adventures of the intrepid people who actually went out into the field and recorded. And there was one story I liked very much where they'd, two guys working on the survey had been on Dartmoor, and they'd called it a village and introduced themselves. And the first cottage or house they came to, they were welcomed in and made very welcome and plied with tea and cake and kept talking. And then the police arrived. And the people in the village had two convicts had escaped from Dartmoor that day or the day before. And the villagers decided that these peculiar people asking strange questions must be the convicts. So they'd sent for the police. So our guys had to sort of talk their way out of this situation. And they told me, one or two of them told me that their various methods for introducing themselves, because you can't just walk up to somebody and ring their doorbell and say, excuse me, I want to come and listen to how you talk. You have to sort of do it in a roundabout way. And they said one of the things they used to do was go and see the vicar and ask for his suggestions as to which the parishioners had, the people they recorded had to be, as I recall, over 60 and preferably born or brought up in that village or that area. I think those were the criteria. So they'd go and get a shortlist off the vicar, and then they'd trot off, and then they'd go and meet these people and say, Reverend so-and-so sent me. And then, of course, the people felt obliged to invite them in, because otherwise it would have not been polite to the vicar. And the other thing one of them told me is he developed a limp, and he used to hobble up the path, leaning heavily on a stick. And then, of course, they felt obliged to invite him in to sit down. So this was another method they used of sort of worming their way into people's houses. And there may have been other methods as well, but it's not easy to ask people suddenly to talk in their dialect. You know, you have to do it rather carefully, I was told. So I do remember the story about the escaped convicts. That was very funny. And there was one recording which I heard, I listened to several times, and I absolutely treasured it. And it was an old gentleman in Cornwall, elderly man in Cornwall, who had said that he liked to sit up in bed at night and smoke a pipe. And the guy interviewing him said, and what does your wife think about that? To which the answer was, me wife, oh bugger her, I don't sleep with her. Lovely, I loved it.
Did you ever listen to any of the other recordings?
I did, but I remember that Cornish accent. I can still reproduce it after all these years, because I thought it was so funny. I don't sleep with her. I thought it was lovely.
Where would you have been listening to those recordings exactly?
I think in our lunchtime. They weren't part of while I was actually working. It was in the lunchtime I listened to some of them, because we had them all there and I would listen to some of them. I mean, there were some I couldn't understand. You know, some of the rural Northumberland accents are very difficult to follow, particularly difficult. Yeah.
And those fantastic stories about field work, when would you have been told those and by whom?
Possibly by the other editors, but one or two of the field workers did call in and have a chat, so I may have heard it from one of those.
Do you remember what they were like?
Not really, no. There was one curious little thing that turned up, which I remember was one of the questions had been, what does a mother call the cloth that she wraps round her baby's legs to keep it clean? Because you can't use the word nappies, or they'll say that, you see. And this was in Cornwall, I think, and the reply had been, or we call them gaiters. And Martin, or one of the other editors, had simply struck it through and said, no, this can't be right. And so they ignored it. And I thought, why would they call them gaiters if there was no reason for it? And so I went and looked up in a book of medieval English. Is there one called Partridge? Does that ring a bell? Would it be Partridge? Anyway, I looked up this book of medieval terminology and I came across the word gaitling, meaning a young child. And I went back to the editor and I said, look, I think possibly that might be the word they were using, which is interesting because today gaiters means something that men generally wear between the knee and the ankle, but it seems that possibly earlier it actually was a word for a nappy, what we call a nappy. But that was the only time I dared disagree with an editor. That was my one and only time when I went and looked that word up.
What was Martin like?
He was pleasant enough to work with, yes. I don't remember a lot, really. Harold used to pop in from time to time, about once a week or twice a week, to see how we were getting along. And I always enjoyed talking to Harold. And I remember making him a birthday cake, because we knew it was his birthday the following day. And I knew that he was likely going to call in. So I made this birthday cake, and my husband was quite indignant. He said, what are you making a birthday cake for other people for? He said, let his wife make him a birthday cake. And I said, well, his wife probably made him a birthday cake at home, but this is for us editors and sub-editors to share with him when he comes in. So I made this cake. So Harold was quite pleased.
Did you all share it?
We did, yes.
What would you say, what would you say, Fran, was the spirit of the project?
I don't really have any comment on that. I mean, it was, I don't know. To be quite honest, because I knew nothing about it beforehand, I wasn't, and I had no sort of training in linguistics whatsoever, I wasn't desperately interested in. I was certainly very interested in the dialect words that we came across, some of which I recognised, you know, myself, from having lived in Yorkshire for a number of years. I was very interested in the dialect terms that came up, but I wasn't desperately interested. I hated to say it, but I wasn't that interested in the survey. I mean, I was very glad when it was published, and I was once shown a set of copies. I think it came out in six books. I seem to remember they were dark green, the cover, and I was told my name was in the credits in book two, I think.
So I have a copy here.
Have you? Has it got my name in?
It does.
Oh, wow. And they're green?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen those since 1966.
So these are the basic materials volumes.
Oh.
This is
I
actually
remembered green then. I haven't seen those since 66.
So this is volume three.
Oh, it's volume three, is it?
Yeah.
And I'm in it.
Yeah. So it's the East Midland Counties in East Anglia, volume three, part one. And if I turn to the preface, you'll find yourself mentioned in that first paragraph there.
Oh. Yeah, there I am, Claire Gilbert I was then. I've kept changing my name. Pauline Duncan. I think perhaps Miss Pauline Duncan might have been the lady I remember who left very soon after I arrived. I just have a memory there was another lady there, but she left very soon afterwards, so it might have been her.
Do you think if you saw a photograph of her now?
No, I've not got that sort of visual memory for faces. Even today, it's a handicap. I meet people and then I meet them a week later and I don't remember who they are. I'm terrible. There's no way I'd remember what she looked like.
So you didn't spend much time with her then?
I was book two. This is volume three, part one.
Yeah, I did check that. I checked all the volumes, and this is the one with your name in it.
The phonetic transcriptions were checked back to the original recording books by Miss Duncan and Mrs. Gilbert. So that's what I was doing.
So I think, Fran, you would have had the field workers' original notebooks.
I did.
Can you remember any more about what
they were
like?
Maybe they were the blank things then, with were written in pencil. I just remember these blank books all being written in pencil. So I was checking the phonetic transcriptions. Well, I'm glad to know what I was doing. If you'd asked me, you see, it's too long ago, Rosie, honestly. I've done too many things since then, and that was the first paid work I ever did.
And you said the pay was a bit modest.
Abysmal, really, but that's all they could afford to pay. And I didn't mind because I had a husband who was working. Not that he was paid very much either in those days, but we managed. We were happy. We lived in a flat in Hyde Park.
How would you get to work every day?
I took the bus to the university and then walked from the side of the university and walked across the campus.
I wonder if you recognise any of these photos, Fran?
I remember the building. I don't remember the people.
It's okay if you don't recognise anyone.
No, I've not a good memory for faces. I think... I think that might be me.
Really? Which one?
It looks like it. But I can't be sure. Honestly, I'm terrible at remembering. I mean, I was 21, you know.
Which one do you think is you?
Well, it's the only lady there.
Okay.
Could be.
Well, there are two ladies in that photo.
Are there?
Yeah, there's...
Well, maybe it's not me then.
There's potentially someone called Mary Hodges. I don't know if you ever came across her.
I can't remember names. Harold. I recognise Harold. Oh, well, it's not me then.
It could be. Because there, do you remember Vera Cracknell?
I don't remember names. I mean, I know Harold, but I don't remember the names of the other people. I'm sorry, it's just too long ago.
No problem.
And I didn't keep in touch with any of them after, because I left to, I had my first child in July 66, and after that I was very much tied up being a mother. And I didn't work again until my second daughter started school, so I was all tied up with being a mum of a baby then. I didn't keep in touch with these people. I mean, no, well, it can't have been me then. Not like,
it
unlike,
could be. It
looked
could
quite
be
like me at that. I had hair like that. Could be. And of course, we all wore dresses in those days. Much more than we do now. Is that Harold?
Yeah.
Gosh. Must have been taken. He looked old. No, he was definitely looked older than that when I knew him. And he died. He was in his 70s when he died, wasn't he?
Do you recognise that person?
No.
That's Stanley Ellis.
Ah, I only saw Stanley very occasionally.
Okay.
Because he was not involved in what we were doing. Very occasionally he'd flip past. But I wouldn't think I saw him more than two or three times. So I wouldn't recognise him. I know about him, though.
What did people say about him?
Just that he was a great expert on dialects, that he was very famous. That's Mary Lee. Yeah, that's the sort of desk we worked at. Yeah, because I remember there was a big row of books between me and Martin, like that. It could even have been that desk that I was working at another time.
What was the atmosphere like in the office?
Oh, fairly cheerful. We were all fairly friendly. Everybody was doing their own thing.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry I don't have more memories, but it was just too long ago.
Not a problem. You've given me some fantastic memories. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Well, I remember the funny bits, particularly about the... the guy's getting arrested for asking suspicious questions. Is this still recording?
It is. Would you like me to stop it?
I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's anything else to tell you. I did tell you. I told you about the that row of terraced houses was pulled down some years later, and in the garden of one of them, they found a number of infant skeletons, and research showed that a baby farmer had lived in one of those in the early years of the 20th century, and these must have been some of the little ones you were looking after. And I often wondered if it was the house that I'd been working in. I never knew which house it was, but if it wasn't, it was one very near. It was in that row of houses, when they demolished them. I remember reading about it in the paper. Yeah. I don't think I can tell you more than that, really. I'm sorry my memories aren't much use, as I said to you.
They're great. Your memories are great. They're wonderful, yeah.
So, I wish I remembered the names of the people, but apart from Martin, I don't remember the names of the other people.
Yeah. Some of the other editors you might have been working alongside would be Michael Barry. Do you remember that name? No. Or Philip Tilling? No.
I shouldn't.
Doesn't matter.
It's just so long ago.
Yeah.
And I've done so many things since then. And that was not really an important part of my life. I was more, you know, I was pregnant for part of that time and looking forward to being a mother, and I was sort of thinking in that direction. And this was not my subject at all. I know you've transferred from English Lit to languages, but it was never my particular interest. But I did enjoy the dialects. And when I must say, when I first came up to Leeds University, as I said, my parents were both Yorkshire folk. But I was brought up, because my father was in the civil service and moved around. I lived first in Cambridge and then in Surrey. And I was the only girl from my year at Croydon High School, my class at Croydon High School, who wanted to go north. But I did, because I felt my roots were up. Instinctively, I always felt I was a northerner. Living in Surrey, I just wanted to go north. I just felt that I was a northerner. And so I went to Leeds University. And it took me a little while to get used to the way people talked, because I hadn't been exposed to it en masse, as it were. And I remember when I first started at university, we freshers were each assigned a second-year student just to show us round, as they do, you know, when you first join university. Somebody shows you the ropes and shows you where everything is. And I remember the mother of my student saying to me, "Are you courting?" And I didn't know what she meant. Because down south, we talked about going out with somebody. If you were dating a boy, you were going out with somebody. I had never heard this term, courting. So I looked at her blankly, "Are you courting?" And I still remember her saying this. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to get to grips with the way people talk round here, or I'll look like an idiot. So I had to bone up on it rather quickly.
Do you think your own use of language changed at all from living in different places?
I think so. I've worked abroad for most of my working life, but my husband is a Scot from the area of Perthshire where we're living now, and we've been married 45 years. He doesn't speak with a Scottish accent, but he does use Scottish terms, and I am so completely used to the way people talk round here. I use these expressions without even thinking about it. Like, for example, if you're going shopping for food, you're doing your messages. I say to somebody, "I'm doing my messages," and I don't think about it. That's what you say round here. And children round here are not bairns as they are in some parts of Scotland. They're wains. It's how are the wains? And how's yourself is the greeting here. How's yourself the day? It's how's yourself the day? And I'm so used to this now, I use this myself. Although I haven't got a Scottish accent, I haven't quite got that far. But I just adapt to the local terms. And I did in Yorkshire as well. You have to.
Can you remember any of the terms from Yorkshire that you would use?
Not really. It was a long time ago that I lived there. Anyway, here I have to be as near as possible Scottish and support Scotland, because that's where I live and that's where my home is.
What does dialect mean to you?
Nothing. I don't understand the question, sorry.
I suppose I mean, what does it mean to you personally? Different ways of speaking, dialect words?
I think that it enriches people's lives to have dialect, and I'm very, very glad that the BBC, who at one time were frightfully sniffy about anybody who didn't speak with a BBC accent, now you hear all sorts of accents. From the newsreaders and from people, the people introducing programmes on television, you hear every accent under the sun. And this is as it should be. And the BBC, I think, did a lot of harm in crushing this use of accents on the radio and television. It was silly. Why shouldn't people talk like the way they were brought up? And I've got my three of my my three Yorkshire grandsons are coming up weekend after next to stay, and they are all brought up in Ilkley. And they have the broadest West Yorkshire accents. It's quite funny listening to them. Real e-bar gum kind of accents. And it's quite funny listening to my grandsons talking like this. But, you know, a few years ago, I would have been thinking, that's going to set them back getting a job talking like that. But now I don't think like that at all. And I don't think it will. I think people have a right to talk in the way that is spoken where they came from. And I did some teaching in Leeds in 73 to 75. I did do a postgraduate certificate in education at one stage. And I did a couple of years teaching, the only time I've ever taught in Britain. And I taught down Chapeltown, which was a pretty rough area. And the school I was in was 93% children of West Indian origin. And we were very, very careful when we were teaching to make it clear to the children that it was perfectly all right for them to speak in their own dialect at home. And most of them were from St. Kitts and Nevis, because West Indians, when they settle in a place, tend to, from the different islands, they settle in different areas. So we had almost nobody from Jamaica, but our kids were almost all, the parents were from St. Kitts and Nevis. And we made it very clear to the children that, well, I particularly felt very strongly about this, it was perfectly all right to use their own dialect and their own language at home and among each other. But for the sake of communicating with the wider world, they were going to have to learn standard English as well, even though it might seem like a different language. Just to get along in the wider world, you've got to have standard English. But nothing wrong at all with using your songs and your chat in your own dialect. And of course, I got to understand quite a lot of their own particular St. Kitts dialect as well when I was working. They were a delight to work with, these kids. So that's what I think about dialect now. And it's a shame that inevitably the media has blurred or wiped out the use of dialect in some ways. I think it's a shame if dialect terms are lost. And I was very glad that the people who were working on the dialect survey before I joined it recorded all the things like the names for all the bits of horse harness for ploughing, because ploughing by horses was still going on in the 50s and in the 60s. We had a cottage in the Yorkshire Dales and we saw people ploughing with horses, and all those names would now be lost if they hadn't been recorded then, because once something's no longer used, the name just drops out. So I was very glad they'd done that kind of work.
That's so interesting. How much of an idea did you get of the ways of life that were recorded by the survey, as well as the language?
I don't, not a lot, except that they were able to interview people like blacksmiths and farriers and wheelwrights, you know, trades that have more or less died out now.
And what does it mean to you, Fran, to know that you contributed to this archive that's still being used by linguists today?
Well, I'm glad if my own very small way, if I was able to do anything to help, then I'm glad, although my contribution was very, very small. I was a sort of amateur bumbling along in the background, trying to keep my nose above water. But if I contributed in any way, then I'm glad. And at least I discovered that word gaitling for a baby that nobody else had tracked down.
Do you feel like doing a little dialect survey with me now?
Can do, yes.
Okay.
Is that the one that Claire was handing out? Or?
Yes, it is.
My daughter filled it in.
Did she?
And I said, well, one of my daughters did, and I said, what are you filling this in for? You've lived in Australia for the last 30 years. I said, you've no business to fill that in. No, that's, we're going out to stay with her next month. I'm going for nearly 3 months. To Queensland.
Wow.
So I have another lot of grandchildren who speak like rednecks from the outback of Queensland, because that's where they're born. They've got interesting accents, my grandchildren.
I bet. Okay.
And I've got two who've just moved from East London to North Berwick, and I'm waiting for them to pick up a Scottish accent. I hope they do.
I'm sure it won't be long.
Because at the moment they've got dreadful Essex accents, and I don't like the Essex accents. I'm hoping they'll pick up a bit of North Berwick.
Why don't you like the Essex ones?
Oh, I don't like the way they speak. I don't like... The accents I dislike most are Birmingham. The Birmingham, I can't bear them.
Why?
But I just don't like the way Brummies speak. I just don't like it. But an occasion a few years ago, this is a salmon fishing river here. It's the River Lion, just runs along 5 minutes walk over those fields, you know, on the River Lion, and it's a salmon fishing river. And the salmon fishing, people pay a lot for salmon fishing, a huge amount. And they're a bit fussy if people come messing about in kayaks. And I'm told there was somebody fishing down at a place called Peter's Pool, just down the road here. And two girls came past in a kayak, and he wasn't pleased about it at all, disturbing the fish. And he said, "And where are you from?" And they said, "Birmingham." What he meant was, "Where did you get the kayak, which, you know, who supplied it to you?" Because there are people who supply it up and down the river, you know, boats and canoes and things. That is what he meant. But they said, "Birmingham," as they paddled past. That was so funny. No, I don't like the way Brummies speak, but that's just a personal thing. But I like Tynesiders. I like listening to their accent. I was in Bahrain once talking to a taxi driver. God, did he have a Geordie accent? And I said, "You've been in Newcastle or somewhere like that?" And he said, "No." He said, "I was in the Merchant Navy for years, the Bahrain Merchant Navy, that is." And he said, "We were in and out of the Tyneside." And I learnt my English off those Tynesiders, and that's why I had this accent. Seemed funny coming from a Bahraini.
So, Fran, what do you call this creature?
I call it hedgehog.
Thank you very much.
Are you recording this?
I am.
Oh.
Is that okay?
Yes, yes.
It's not a test.
I thought it was something I had to fill in.
No, well, in the interviews we do it orally. And what about this? Do you have a name for this?
A daddy long legs.
Thank you. And how about these?
Is it an earwig? I'm not sure which creature it is.
It is an earwig.
It's not a devil's coach horse. That's bigger. It's an earwig, yes.
Thank you. And what do you call this type of garden weed?
Well, I knew it as cleavers, but up here in Perthshire we call it sticky willy. And that's what I call it now, is sticky willy. If I said cleavers, nobody would believe me. Wouldn't understand what I meant.
And in the morning in the garden...
Or goosegrass. I know it as goosegrass as well. Yes.
Which one do you think you use the most?
Well, here I use sticky willy because that's what we call it. But when I was a child, I used either cleavers or goosegrass. Yeah.
Thank you. And in the morning in the garden, you'd say this is a drop of...
Dew. Do people call it anything else? There isn't another name for dew.
Could be.
Oh.
And this is a bag of?
No, they're sweets. Yeah, I'd call those sweets.
What do you call one of these?
I'd call it a bun.
And...
That's interesting, doing it with pictures.
What about these?
Scones.
And how many can you see in the picture?
2.5.
What's the number that comes after 2?
3.
What is your word for these?
Spring onions. Well, I know there's other names like scallions, is what the Americans call them. Yeah, but I don't use that. I know scallions because I see it in recipe books. I call them spring onions.
And what is this?
A piggyback.
And this?
A seesaw.
Thank you very much.
The Americans call it a teeter-totter, don't they?
Yeah.
That's a nice name.
It's one of my favourites.
You ought to have shown me a picture of a woodlouse, because here they're called slaters. Did you know that term? Here it's a slater. That was one I had to learn. I didn't know slaters, but I call them woodlice. Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, I've also got a couple of sentences. If you could complete this sentence by selecting the words from the multiple choice that you would use in a conversation with friends.
I said.
Thank you.
Afraid I speak fairly standard English, you know.
And again, complete the sentence by selecting the word that you would use in a conversation with friends.
I'd say really, probably, if I liked the food. I'd say the food was really tasty.
Thank you. Lovely. Okay, and I've got some
very, very boring, I'm afraid, Rosie. I don't use many dialect terms. And remember, you know, I was brought up in the South, but by Yorkshire parents. So I don't have any sort of dialect background.
It's interesting to hear everybody's dialect story. Mm. Okay, a few quick fire questions to finish off. What do you call a room in a house for storing food?
A larder.
If you haven't eaten any food for a very long time, you're bound to feel...
hungry. Here, starved. Yes.
Do you use starved?
I don't use starved, but I know perfectly well that you're starved. Or clemmed. In Yorkshire, we say clemmed. Yeah. But I know the terms, but I would say I'm starving.
Was there a time in your life you'd ever used clemmed?
No, but I know perfectly well what it means.
What words do you use for something to eat?
Food.
What about perhaps between meals?
A snack.
What do you call a coffee that you might get from a fancy cafe with a lot of milk in it?
A white coffee.
Mm-hmm. Any other words that you see on a billboard?
I don't drink coffee, so my husband drinks coffee, and the two of us look hopelessly at the list of coffees, and he's a coffee drinker, and he doesn't know what they mean, and neither do I, and he just says he wants a coffee with milk in it, a white coffee. So we don't know what all. I don't know what a latte is. I see the word, but I don't know what they are, and I don't drink. I have never drunk coffee at any time. So, coffee language is a foreign language to me.
What's the dairy product that you spread on toast and sandwiches?
Butter, I suppose, but I don't use it.
That's fine. Do you have a word or a phrase that would indicate a temporary break in a game, and during that time points can't be scored?
I don't know. I can't think of any. What do other people say for that? Are there words?
There are lots of words. It's sort of like a childhood game type of thing in the playground. If you were to sort of pause the game and say, you might do this.
Oh, feigns. That's it. Yeah, feigns. You say feigns. If you're saying feint, if you're playing tag and you do that, you can't be touched. That's it, feigns, yes.
And that's
but
what
that's when I was a child in Cambridgeshire, yes.
Thank you.
I was thinking you meant a board game for some reason, not a playground game. Now I understand, mm-hmm. Yes.
If you got covered in dirt at the playground, when you get home, you might need to get in the...
get in a...
to wash off.
Can you say the question again?
If you got very dirty at the playground, when you get home, you might need to get in the...
a bath? We didn't have showers when I was a child.
When children are very excited, you might say that they're full of...
I don't know.
That's fine. At the end of a long and tiring day, you'd say you were absolutely...
just say tired out.
Which word would you use to mean not attending school when you should be attending school?
You mean when you're supposed to be at school and you're not, skiving? Mm.
Sometimes when children are being very naughty, their parents tell them that someone will come and take them away. Do you have a name for this mysterious person?
I've never been used.
You grow crops.
I know it was everything from Adolf Hitler to Napoleon. Boney will come and get you. Boney will come and get you with the threat in the at the time of the Napoleonic Wars. If you're not good, Boney will come and take you away. Yes.
Mm. You grow crops and raise animals on a
farm? Is that what you mean? Yes.
When you walk in the countryside after heavy rain, your shoes will get covered in
mud.
And when you're driving or walking in icy or wet weather, you must take care because the roads are...
This is in wet weather, is it?
Wet or icy. You need to be careful because the roads are...
Might say greasy or just slippery. In fact, I commented this morning, driving into Aberfeldy, how much mud has been tracked onto the road by farm vehicles. It's particularly bad this morning. And I said to my husband, this is quite dangerous, because if it rains, cars will be skidding all over the place. So the problem around here is mud on the road that can cause accidents.
Which words do you use, if any, as a term of endearment, even with strangers?
I suppose dear, if it's a woman or a girl. I don't say love like a lot of Yorkshire people do. Yes.
Yeah. Do you just not use a word like that? Like if you were in a shop or something, would you say dear?
No. We say dear to friends, but it's not a term I use very much anyway.
Great. Which word would you use to refer to someone as being very attractive?
If it's a man or a woman, or doesn't it matter? I'd just say good looking or pretty or beautiful. If it's a really pretty woman, I'd say, oh, she's really beautiful. Yes.
And if it was a man?
Handsome.
What's your word for spreading rumours?
Tattling or gossiping.
A picture on the wall not hanging straight is hanging...
crooked or askew. I might say it's hanging askew or it's hanging crooked. Yes.
What do you call a very small piece of wood that's got into your finger?
Splinter.
What do you call a person who mends shoes and boots?
Well, you'd be lucky to find one these days. There isn't one for miles around here. I'd call them a cobbler or a shoemaker. Around here they tended to call them shoemakers rather than cobblers, but I know the word cobbler. I don't think there's one nearer than Perth now. It used to be local.
And do you have any other words that you'd like to tell us about from anywhere in your life that you use?
Not really. No, you just pick things up wherever you are. We lived in Arabic-speaking countries and we still use Arabic a little to each other, just odd words. Like, I never ever say that I'm going to do something in the future without saying inshallah. Inshallah, God wills, if God wills. And where I lived in the Middle East, it was really bad luck to say on Thursday I'm going to do this, or at the weekend I'm going to do this, without saying inshallah. It was bringing bad luck on yourself if you didn't say inshallah, if God wills. And I still say inshallah. But a lot of my friends around here, they've all worked in Arabic countries, so they're all familiar with the term. So we all say inshallah, inshallah, if God wills.
Any other words that you picked up from the Middle East?
Oh, all sorts of expressions. He says Habibi sometimes to me, which is beloved wife, you know, Habibi. Yeah. Just odd phrases like this. I only learnt a little Arabic when I was over there. And when I was in northern Nigeria, the Hausa was the lingua franca, so I had to go to lessons there given by one of the American missionaries, just to learn enough Hausa to be able to manage in the market. It wasn't the local language, it was the lingua franca. It's a bit like Swahili, it's that sort of a language. And I picked up quite a bit of that, and I was quite pleased when I went to Arabia to find that some of the things were the same, like the numbers. A lot of the numbers are the same in Hausa as in Arabic.
Yeah. Wow. You've got a very interesting language story.
I don't think those words I was telling you were much use, because I'm not tied to any particular dialect area, because I've lived, you know, I was brought up in Cambridge. I can't hear that I have a Cambridge accent, but Harold seemed to detect it. And I'm sure I didn't put anything in my CV about where I don't think he was cheating. I think he really could detect it. He was famous for this. Yeah. Remarkable man, Harold, he was. And I'm pleased to hear his daughter's still alive. But you don't know how many children he had.
I'm not certain.
No, I don't know anything about his background. I'll tell his daughter that one of his most humble servants remembers him with affection.
I certainly will.
Have you switched this off now?
Yeah. Thank you ever so much for your time, Fran. It's been a real privilege.
Well, I feel I'm a fraud. I feel I haven't given you much information at all.
Not at all. It's been wonderful.
Sorry I'm so vague about the detail to what we were actually doing.
So you were saying?
Yeah, one of the things that I was very interested in was I was told that in some cases Roman roads formed a dialect boundary. And I was wondering, I never received an explanation as to why this was, but I was told definitely dialects sometimes change from one side of a Roman road to the other. But then I was told about Woodhouse Moor in Leeds, that there were four different dialects for the four sides of the moor. There were four different, slightly different pronunciations. And that was right in the heart of Leeds. And another little anecdote I remember is that I was told that one old gentleman who was being recorded thought that the tape recorder had been invented specially to record him. He didn't know it had ever been used for anybody else. And of course, in those days, they were clunky reel-to-reel jobs, quite big things that you had to carry around. But this old boy thought it was specially made just to record him, which is nice.
You don't know where he was from.
No, I can't remember that.
That's a wonderful story.
Mm.